down the ground.
We're
receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 521.JB1817, certificate number 34402, generic food.
When I was a kid, my mother would never buy any name brand foods. Never a name brand. Be in the supermarket, Ma, could we get some Jif peanut butter?
You got some Jif money?
Never a name brand food. You know my mother used to buy all the time the no-frills food. You ever see the no-frills food, the white box with the black letters?
How much brand loyalty would you say you have on a scale of 1 to 10?
I would say that's a good question. I'm without giving free advertising to a half a dozen products that have not paid to be on the Omnibus.
Just use the ones who have paid. How much loyalty do you have to Mack Weldon, some kind of Miro collaboration software?
I'm wearing the Mack Weldon underwear right now. There's a certain brand of frozen pizza that I like, and I don't like any other brand of frozen pizza. So if I can't get the one, I won't get any others. I'm a pepper. I like Dr. Pepper. I know you like Dr. Pepper.
I'm a diet pepper.
They're not going to advertise on the show probably, but my great-grandfather was also a pepper.
Really?
He would go to town in Van Wert, Ohio in 1932, and while his wife went to the Woolworths, he would buy a single Dr. Pepper and stand out on the corner of First and Main and drink his, savor his Dr. Pepper for an hour.
What was she doing at the Woolworths? Was she having a cherry phosphate or was she shopping?
I think she was shopping. She was buying the thing, she was buying chicken feet or whatever you get at Woolworths.
Yeah, chicken feet. But did you say feed or feet?
Feed, but sure, feet.
Yeah, it's two different aisles.
And he would stand there and everyone in town would pass by and having his Dr. Pepper was his opportunity to talk to his townspeople, his fellow townspersons. And that, because they lived on a farm way out in the middle of BFE. So
that was his bar, just standing on a street corner with
having a Dr. Pepper.
And that was the only drink available in America at the time. Water was not safe to drink.
Sarsaparilla.
Yeah, exactly. You could have Dr. Pepper or you could have a delicious. So I remember when I was a kid, this is not relevant at all, but there's some encyclopedia. Yeah, for a change. How can it be not relevant? We haven't even talked about anything yet. This is everything right now is a perfect democracy of relevance. There's some Encyclopedia Brown mystery I read as a kid that hinges on root beer and sarsaparilla tasting exactly the same.
Right. Well, this is what they'll tell you.
And that's not true.
If you go to the United Kingdom and try and talk to people about root beer, they're going to tell you that root beer and cough syrup taste exactly the same.
I know that. Yeah.
And of course, they're wrong.
But it's funny. We've tricked a generation of kids into thinking that root beer is delicious by giving it to them as a sparkly soda, whereas if you told them it was for their throat, they would be like, don't make me have that.
Right. I love a root beer. But I'm also, so this is an example, right? I am not a root beer brand purist. I'll drink six different root beers.
At the same time, you'll stir them all together in a big vat.
It's even better. That's how you make Dr. Pepper. You put six root beers together.
I know you're not I know you're kind of an airline loyalist. You poo-poo people who will just buy the cheapest ticket.
Well, after decades of buying the cheapest ticket and realizing that my life was twice as hard and unpleasant because I fly a lot.
You needed a system. You needed order.
And I just took, I just chose the airline that I chose because a friend of the show, John Hodgman, and friend of the show, Jonathan Colton, both.
You just essentially named it because Hodgman's book is named for a trademark of this company.
But 12 years ago, they both sat me down and shook me by the lapels and they were like, you need to get right with the airlines. Like you need to get on this mileage program.
Is that Delta's? I didn't know that was their, they're a multi-level marketing program.
They are.
Does Hodgman, are you in his downline? Does he get a few cents on the dollar every time you buy a ticket?
Well, what was cool is we were traveling a lot together. And so he would get these. He would get first class upgrades for me all the time because we'd be flying from here to there. And he was in first class and his magic platinum power got me in first class over and over. And he was like, if you're not saving up these Delta points, you're just like throwing money on the ground. I was like, God, I don't want to throw money on the ground. That sounds like a dumb thing. So I signed up and then I got caught in that whole craziness of like, I'm trying to get my status every year. I felt like I'd been twice duped.
First, you thought you were going to, you lost the ease of just buying the cheapest ticket and somehow you joined a cult.
Right.
Without even wanting
joined a terrible cult because, you know, once you're in their cult, they can treat you as badly as they want. And you're like, no, please give me more.
What are you going to do? Go to American?
Yeah.
I don't think
I was sitting on a flight one time, again, like upgraded to first class. And the guy next to me, the flight attendant opened a can of pop or whatever and a little drip got on his pants and he was totally cool about it. And the flight attendant was like, oh, sir, I'm so sorry. Here, why don't I give you 10,000 miles on your Delta card? And I was like,
pour some on me.
Yeah. I was like, some got on me and they both laughed. And then on subsequent flights, you know, I've had flight attendants spill hot coffee on me and I'm like, well, you know, you could make it right. And they're like, sorry. And skate off. And I was like, what? Oh, it's just whatever flight attendant wants to, they can just upgrade you to gold status or
maybe that guy was some special. Cause they do have a chart that tells them this guy was, has been gold 3 years running. He's platinum. He's, you know, and then that's when you get the old, hey, Mr. Roderick, thank you for your
service.
Thank you for your loyalty. It's not really service, is it? When you think about it.
Well, the way they think about it. But the thing is, every once in a while, I did have to fly on American or United and realize that, I mean, there are worse things than being on Delta.
You have to do it every so often to keep you humble.
Yeah, and being on American is worse, but being on United, I don't even see how people can live like that. But I'm not a loyalist, a brand loyalist for things like coffee. I'll drink whatever coffee you have. I've driven both Fords and Chevys.
Wow.
I've...
Non-binary.
That's right.
The two genders, Ford and Chevy.
I play both Fenders and Gibsons. Like, in a lot of the things where I know people that become super dedicated to one... to what seem like a kind of bicameral universe, like you're either a Fender or a Gibson.
And a lot of these choices are tribalism that, right? It's not that... Like, can you tell this coffee's good and this one's less good?
Yes.
Yes.
And I often don't, you know, the real coffee fashion people really love Ethiopian light roast, super acidic coffee. And I don't like it. I like dark roast, Central American chocolate tasting coffee. And so when I go places and they're like, oh, you're going to love this. We have the latest. I'm like, I don't, it's really, the latest coffee is not what I'm interested in. I want your old fashioned dad coffee. Darker the better.
I was thinking about which things I care about because, you know, anytime you've been in some kind of either long time or temporary poverty, you're very aware of which brands are 8 cents less or whatever on the shelf. And there are some things where like, In college, I would always buy the 19-cent store brand macaroni and cheese.
Right.
And it was terrible. Like, there is a big difference between Kraft and Food Town macaroni and cheese.
Yes. The cheese gets brighter and brighter and brighter.
That orange color is not found in nature, except maybe in Trinity, New Mexico. So, and I asked Mindy, which things will you buy the store brand of? And she was very poo-pooing store brands. And I kind of went through the cabinets and I was like, you bought this can of beans. She was like, well, sure, beans. Well, you bought these, well, sure, peaches. And I said, what about ketchup? And she's like, oh no,
Heinz.
I would never buy store brand ketchup. And I was like, really? I don't think I would taste the difference in a lot of these no frills brands.
I could not possibly use store brand raspberry jam. I will spend extra for good jam because the gulf between good jam and bad jam is so, so broad.
I buy the weird French ones in the plaid little jars.
Me too.
You do too.
Because that stuff is delicious.
I'm not just fooling myself, no, right?
Like those mamans, those are so much better.
But there is something in the brain where like, I think I could be being fooled by the, nope, by the plaid jar.
Afraid not. Jar. That stuff is good. If you go to the Oregon Country Fair or you go up to Skykomish and buy some handmade raspberry jam, that stuff is really good. But it's also $14 a jar. so you gotta split the difference.
Yeah, if it costs three times as much, but it's only like 1.2 times as good, you're throwing your money away, John.
Yeah, I will almost always buy the generic medicine.
Yes,
because I feel like buying Sudafed or buying
there's not a recipe.
Bartell's version. Yeah, right. It's just like how much of the active ingredient.
Acetaminophen is acetaminophen, right? It's not like this is government B grade acetaminophen. Yeah, and that was Mindy's bright line test too. She was like, anything with a recipe.
Oh,
a can of kidney beans doesn't have a recipe, but I'm not buying store brand Oreos because they will just taste like college and poverty.
Oh, they're awful.
Yeah, they really are.
The one thing I will say is that the reverse snobbery came into this in my college days in the form of beer. We became absolute loyalists of Schmidt beer, which is the cheapest. It's pretty often the cheapest beer. And we fought for Schmidt. If you'd bought really nice beer and a half rack of Schmidt, we would have absolutely gone to the Schmidt first because it became a cult. Like among my little group of Alaskan friends, we just decided that Schmidt was our emblem.
And it can represent something besides that, right? You're a man. I'm a simple man.
Yeah.
I don't need your fruity European beers.
But we wouldn't even drink Schlitz. I mean, we'd drink Ole, but Schmidt was where we lived. But then they came out with generic beer. Do you remember generic beer?
We're going to talk about generic beer.
And we were like, well, if Schmidt is good, then generic beer's got to be great. And generic beer just tasted like, really, really tasted like after they put the Schmidt in cans, whatever was left in the vat, they put into like a plastic garbage bag, left it in the parking lot for a week, and then poured it into
beer. I don't even know why they would do. I mean, that's got to be less efficient to leave it in the parking lot for a week.
It gets more sour. It tastes more like, I don't know, like underwear funk. So I had to draw the line.
I feel like the recipe law does not work for me in one respect, which is I like those big bags of cheap cereal. I feel like I'm getting away with something that I'm not paying for the mascot, the rabbit or the leprechaun.
Yeah, you're a cereal eater. I'm not. But what about?
Oh wait, you don't eat cereal?
No.
Wait, you never eat cereal. How did I not know this?
No.
I just saw numbers, by the way, on the number of people who say they dislike potatoes, and it's like 0.5%.
What? Really?
Yeah, you're like 1 in 200 or something.
0.5%.
Is that higher than you would think?
No, I figured that I had more brethren in the world that didn't like potatoes.
In a room full of 200 people, it's you.
Well, it confirms what I know about the world, which is that everyone else is wrong.
Look around the party. Everybody's got a tater tot on a toothpick, and you're standing alone with your Dr. Pepper.
I know that I'm pretty lonely in the don't eat cereal world too, but I just feel like cereal.
Am I
a horse?
Oh, I see.
You know, like you put some food coloring on some horse food and
no, and but you also put in sugar is the thing.
Sugar and food coloring and milk on horse food, but you don't eat it with milk. I bet you just eat it dry.
No, I eat it with milk. Like that's the whole thing. And I'll eat it in small mini bowls so that it doesn't get soggy. It's all about the texture. You want to have the hard horse food and the cold milk. But I would always in college, and to this day, I would always buy the big bags of off-brand And I remember being at, specifically in college, being at a grocery store and turning down Lucky Charms, even though they were on sale, to get a big bag of marshmallow mateys. And this girl was like, "What are marshmallow mateys?" And I said, "Well, look at them. The bag is transparent. These are just Lucky Charms with a nautical theme." And she thought that was so funny that she actually agreed to go out with me on the strength of me calling marshmallow mateys Lucky Charms with a nautical theme.
Wow.
I might have said maritime theme, which is funnier. Probably nautical.
Well, so when I did eat cereal when I was a kid.
Do you feel like it's immature to eat cereal? Is that a part of it?
I do feel a little
bit. I mean, that's the reason why I don't chew bubblegum.
I do feel like they're a little. It's a little bit kid food, and it's partly because I liked the kid food. I liked the kid version of cereal.
Sure.
And I had a real, I liked Cocoa Pebbles.
Right. They're like Trix, but no, Cocoa Pebbles are like Rice Krispies kind of.
Yeah. Cocoa Pebbles are like Cocoa Krispies, but Cocoa Pebbles, I think, were the low rent Cocoa Krispies.
Is that right? The Flintstone stuff was cheaper.
Yeah, but I really liked it. It was where my taste developed. I preferred, but then you couldn't find Cocoa Pebbles, and so Cocoa Pebbles became this kind of treasure of the Sierra Madre or whatever. You know, I needed to find Cocoa Pebbles, and I would have my mom driving from grocery store to grocery store. I wouldn't settle for less than the worst Flintstones based foods. But like Cocoa Puffs became a cereal that a lot of, there were a lot of knockoffs of Cocoa Puffs.
Well, sure. They're just corn balls dipped in some kind of cocoa powder.
Just as there are a lot of knockoffs of the cheese version of them.
Cheetos.
Thank you.
Is that how you think of Cheetos? Yeah, hey, pass me that bowl of the cheese version of Cocoa Puffs.
The cheese flavored Cocoa Puffs.
Oh, John's had a stroke again.
But they're imitated. You know, there's so many store brand versions of Cheetos, and they're all inedible.
That's what I don't understand.
But Cheetos are the greatest of all foods.
These recipes have to be simple, right? Why can no store make a good store brand Oreo or Storio, if you will, or Cheeto or cola?
They're not using the right quantities of xanthan gum, I think.
Do you think the additives are expensive enough that they're just like, we're leaving out the sodium benzoate or the lecithin, and that's what does it?
What is it? It's got to be, it's always something in the acidity or the some combination of umami and sugar. And I don't know.
Do you think they're just leaving it in a bag in the parking lot and they should skip that step?
It must be. They leave it in the sun too long.
I think I may have told this story in Omnibus before, but speaking of supermarket brands of soda, my brother at a tech company had a fridge in his office at one point, and he would stock it with nothing but the store brands of Dr. Pepper.
Oh, no.
Because you know how every No Frills brand has a Coke, right, a cola equivalent, but they also have a Dr. Pepper equivalent, and they can't say that, so they call it Dr. Thunder, right, or Dr. Safeway, or
Dr. Safeway.
Dr. Sierra, Dr. Craigmont, Dr. Pooper.
Right.
And so he would just fill a fridge. He would go from store to store and just fill a fridge with these awful Dr. Pepper knockoffs, and he did it entirely as a bit, so that when somebody came in his office, he was like, "Hey, do you want a soda?" "Yeah, what do you got?" "Well, I've got Dr. Shasta, I've got Dr. Mountain, I've got..."
See, this is why we can't tax the rich.
Because all
of the humor of life goes away if they don't have both the free time and the resources
and the disposable income
to put gags like this together.
Like, if you just have to go to one, if you just have barely have time to go to one grocery store a week between your two jobs, you can't pull off the Dr.
Right.
Craigmont prank.
No, and then who's going to, and then you steal all the laughter from people. Now, we grew up in the West, so you drank Shasta, right?
Sure.
And I drank Shasta.
Do they still have Shasta, I think?
I don't know, but I loved Shasta, and I liked RC Cola, too.
Coke is one thing where I get annoyed when it doesn't taste like Coke. Is RC Cola good? I can't remember.
Oh, no, but
when,
it was
when I have to drink fine. In Seattle, it's always, I think I've said this, they have Jones Cola, and it just tastes like bubblegum or something because they're using
real sugar.
Yes. Yeah. And real extracts of whatever. And it tastes like a candy store.
How do you feel about Mexican Coke?
I'm not racist. I'm not going to separate.
Okay.
I don't want to separate a family of,
you don't want to take Mexican Coke and put it over here and and Coke Classic and put it over there.
Think what Mexican Coke has done for this building, this country, John.
Yeah, it's reintroduced sugar pop.
Mexican Coke chose to be here. We're here. We're here by coincidence. Mexican Coke loves America more.
There was a, you know, there was actually like an Anchor Coke that came here and then brought Mexican Coke later.
Was RC Cola the Anchor Coke? No, RC Cola is Canadian, isn't it?
I think it was. Machaca. No, what is the word I'm looking for?
Jarritos?
Jarritos. I think it was Jarritos that came and then brought Mexican Coke.
That's the Mexican soda that's beloved in our house because it's fun flavors.
It is fun flavors.
You know, even Fanta is not making a tamarind or a pineapple version.
Yeah, never did.
I think we're going to get letters that there is a pineapple Fanta in the Philippines and Colombia, and we're going to have to issue an apology.
What are your favorite brands? You seem like you know there's enough of a libertarianism in you that it feels like you would resist or reject brand loyalty.
Just on the basis of our consumerism being unhealthy?
Well, no, or just that you're not going to be somebody that's going to be held in prison by Cocoa Pebbles. But maybe I'm projecting.
grocery brands only?
I don't know. What happens when you go to Trader Joe's?
I actually have quite a bit of brand loyalty to Trader Joe's.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do.
Because, I mean, it's hard to park, but a lot of those... It's
hard to walk through those stores. Why are they arranged that way? That's not necessary.
Why is there candy above the freezer case?
Just,
I don't know.
Just make it a square grid.
I mean, Trader Joe's is interesting because a lot of those groceries come off the same assembly lines as name brand products. And they just run the second half of the run with Trader Joe's brand.
Right.
And it's the same with Costco. Like, speaking of brand loyalty, I love Costco. I love
that. But do you wear Kirkland clothes?
Not that much. I think I might. This fleece might be Kirkland.
Boy, a more Ken Jennings sentence was never uttered.
I don't think it is, actually. I think I bought it at Costco.
It is.
Oh, no, it is. Hey, Kirkland. There's the tag.
A Kirkland fleece. Wow.
Because, you know, the regular ones at Target were $18, but this was $16.50.
Sure. When you pull into the charging station for your Nissan Leaf, that Kirkland fleece really keeps the breeze off.
It's a Chevy Volt. The thing about the Costco house, I mean, first of all, Costco is less evil. It pays its employees well and so forth. But their house brand rule is that it has to be as good as top of the line stuff.
Hmm.
Like this fleece or whatever, however their internal quality testing works, is a good fleece. Like the triple distilled French vodka, Kirkland Industries French vodka that they put right next to the Grey Goose is probably Grey Goose.
Hmm.
They just are not allowed to call it such.
It feels even a little bit Consumer Reports though, where it's like, we tested these two fleeces and
that's what I love about it. It's got the circle with the nipple in it, which is the best Consumer Reports thing, right?
Yeah,
you don't want the red half circle.
No,
don't buy the Magnavox. Nobody knows what we're talking about.
I think people that subscribe to Consumer Reports do.
The future should know that there was a brief publishing trend. Well, you know, a couple decades of publishing trend of, people just really enjoying reading about which toaster was better than that toaster, even if they never actually were shopping for a toaster.
When you were a kid, did you, like me, read Consumer Reports cover to cover?
Absolutely. But I loved it when it was something I actually had an opinion on. Like the car stuff I would read, but I would be like, I'm not buying a car. But occasionally they'd have, who has better French fries? Wendy's, Burger King, or McDonald's?
Oh, I read the car things just avidly, but I would sit and read an entire review of like weed trimmers.
Exactly.
And like be rooting for one and like, yes, it got the green circle for reliability.
They were often written in narrative form. It would be like, and then we tried whatever, but the mouthfeel was not as good. Nice. And with larger sized weeds, it was the, speaking of this kind of era, which if you're picturing Consumer Reports as being kind of a late 70s, early 80s phenomenon.
Yeah.
The 1970s were a very hard time to be in the grocery business.
Unlike now, when being a grocer is...
It's just like it's, printing money.
It's its own reward.
It's printing money, but the money is coupons.
Uh-huh.
As a result of Carter-era inflation and, you know, the economic woes of that time...
We didn't whip inflation now, it turned out.
We didn't even whip inflation later. I mean, we whipped inflation gradually.
Eventually,
wig. Like, did you remember that Carter even suggested price freezes on certain kinds of groceries?
I do remember.
Like, it seemed like a crisis, like an unprecedented crisis.
We were a banana republic at the time. Our currency was going to be...
It was a peanut republic, so it was Carter.
Was going to be, you know, we were going to have $1 million bills just to pay for a wheelbarrow. We needed a wheelbarrow for full of cash just to get a box of Cocoa Krispies.
Like Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
And
or Weimar Germany.
And so if you take inflation, exactly, if you take inflation out of the picture, grocery store revenues were flat for the entire decade. Hmm. People just did not have spare money for anything. Like, you know, if they're not spending money for slightly nicer coffee than Maxwell House, you know they're not, you know, buying luxury goods.
You know, those were my prime supermarket days.
Me too.
At the start of the 70s, I was riding in the cart, and by the end of the 70s, I could go to the supermarket by myself. I remember so distinctly the feel of those aisles, those shelves.
I got a free cookie every time I went to the Safeway on 65th.
I went to the grocery store one time, and there was a woman there in a uniform of some kind, holding a tray where she had little cubes of cheddar cheese with toothpicks in them. And she was like, "Would you like to try a piece of cheese?" And having that piece of cheese on a toothpick, the cheese tasted so much better that for, I think, 5 years after that, I only wanted cheese cubed and served with a toothpick.
By a blonde in a uniform?
Like a lady in a flight attendant uniform. And honestly, if you put cheese on a toothpick, I thought it tasted twice as good as cheese in any other form. And I think my mom kind of continued to fool me. Like, rather than get me a birthday cake, she just cubed some cheese and put toothpicks in it. And, you know, and I felt like it was the most deluxe thing you could get.
Do you remember the grocery experimentation at this time? You know, because stores were not making money, they were trying new ways to appeal to kind of no-frills customers.
Green stamps, you mean?
Green stamps, for sure. One thing you had around here, do you remember U-Market? There were a couple stores called U-Market. We used to go to the one in Linwood. There was one on Capitol Hill as well. And if I remember right, the gimmick of U-Market is that they saved money on shelving and price tagging and pass the savings along to you, the customer. So you would have to...
It was just in a big pile in the center of the room?
Basically, you would have to write down with a little grease pencil the price of the thing. You know, the shelves were labeled with what the thing was.
Oh, right.
But you would have to write down on the tag what it was, and then the cashier could ring you up.
Well, that's the...
Literally, that, you mark it.
That's the... isn't that the whole premise of the bin aisle at the super expensive, sure, natural food store?
Imagine a whole building of that, except you're also doing it not just to the coconut flakes.
Did that really save money? But you're doing
it to detergent. And it seems unlikely, right? Like, it almost seems like it was a gimmick designed to make you feel like you were being frugal.
Right. Have you read the articles recently about Dollar General and Family Dollar stores?
How they're kind of taking over?
Well, not just taking over, but they cut costs by not having any employees.
I've noticed.
Or any service of any kind. And what those stores are doing is that they're going into like areas and essentially creating urban decay around them, because they push out other, yeah, retailers and grocers, and then they're also awful. So if you see a Dollar General pop up in your neighborhood, you know that your neighborhood's done, basically. Because they become like crime centers, because there's nobody watching. And
I do have some brand loyalty to dollar stores, actually.
Oh, really?
For one reason alone: sunglasses.
You buy a lot of streamers.
I buy a lot of, I buy a lot of not very good Valentine's Day cards.
What, you wear dollar sunglasses?
I lose sunglasses so often.
Whoa.
That I will just wear $1 sunglasses, because I know I'm going to leave it on a restaurant table next week.
It's crazy, because I have a lot of brand, maybe not loyalty, but brand fascination with sunglasses.
I know you're the opposite here.
Yeah, that's strange.
And how do you not lose them? It's because you're a glasses wearer, I think.
Yeah.
You've got a part of your brain designed to keeping something on the bridge of your nose.
But I do lose them also.
Oh, okay. Well,
sucks.
You're not really a success story.
No, not really. Don't follow me, kids. I'm not a role model.
In addition to kind of no-frills gimmicks like that, this was the dawn of grocery stores branching into what were then called box stores and combo stores. Hmm. The interesting thing is that combo stores became what we today call box stores.
Right. Right.
A place where you can go and buy not just groceries, but all kinds of
lawnmowers,
household and clothing stuff. Yeah, it turns into Walmart and Target. These were called combo stores at the time. And the idea was you could lure a shopper in with one-stop shopping, and you would probably also carry maybe fewer brands. And that was also true of the box stores, which were the places where it's called box stores because they would just leave stuff in crates, basically. Oh. Like instead of putting stuff on nice shelves, you would kind of have a warehouse feel. And this is the beginning of Costco and Sam's Club and kind of the no-frills warehouse shopping of today.
Right.
But these were just all attempts to make frugal customers feel like they were squeezing every last penny. It was, you know, plenty of couponing that hadn't been seen since war rationing returned. And in Europe in particular, there was one invention that a French retail chain called Carrefour, maybe you've probably been in a Carrefour. It's a French, it's a hypermarket, it's Target or whatever, right. Basically. They followed in the footsteps of pharmaceutical companies and decided to look at generics, non-name brand items.
So generic pharmaceuticals were an innovation of the pharmaceutical industry? I would have thought that would be strangely...
They were an innovation of offshoots of the pharmaceutical. I mean, if generic pharmaceutical companies are part of the pharmaceutical industry, yes.
Right. It's not Bayer that's pressing to come up with fake aspirin.
No, Bayer was one of the early litigants of a 1930s court case trying to keep aspirin coming from their factories only. And in fact, in the U.S. at this time, this was before the Hatch-Waxman Act of 1982, which made it a lot easier. It gave generics an easier regulatory pathway, and it kept the patented companies from suing them while they did their all their testing.
1982 really, really set the bar for deregulation. If you're going to pick a year and call it the year of deregulation, I think 82 has got to be right up there.
But I mean, this one, like, are we in favor of this one? Like, I might be in favor of generic, easing the way for generic drugs.
I wish that they hadn't deregulated the airline industry and the banks.
That was the one I was getting. I mean, those two I'm a little more worked up about.
But no, I think, you know, generic beer, generic aspirin, like damn the torpedoes.
I mean, if you make a generic drug, you still have to do all the testing that the company that held the patent did independently.
Oh, you can't.
And you can't start until the patent runs out.
Really? You can't just ride their coattails and say, it's all the same ingredients.
I'll just put acetaminophen in mine. Right. No. But in Europe, apparently, there had been more of a tradition of low-cost drugs to pass savings along to pharmacy shoppers.
Well, because in Europe, they use homeopathy, where there's no drug in it in the first place.
It's how they make Schmidt.
It's just one molecule
of beer.
Right, some oil, and then you breathe across the top of it after you had a piece of gum, and it's supposed to cure cancer.
So Carrefour, having seen, you know, pharmacy success of these low-cost drugs, decides to put low-cost groceries on its shelf.
I'd also just like to point out, if you're a homeopathist, that you should write your letter of complaint to ken@omnibusproject.com.
I think we both make fun of homeopathy.
I suppose don't we? Probably we do, yeah.
The water remembers, John.
But it's,
even if there's not a single molecule of essential oil left.
But it's out of love. It's out of love. I've dated enough students at Bastyr College that I don't want to get in any more trouble.
We don't want you to die. I mean, John doesn't want to screw up his dating pool of naturopathic doctors.
Right.
But also, we don't want you to die.
No.
By thinking that you can put a little penicillin in water and then just drink the water.
If it is required that you die in order that my access to naturopathic doctor dating pool isn't restricted, I'm willing to.
There's got to be a number. There's got to be a number of people you're willing to see go.
Yeah.
And what is that number?
It's a risk. It's a risk to reward ratio.
Do you have actuarial tables
I'm
for this?
I'm willing to risk a certain number of people in order to continue to date naturopathic doctors.
So in 1976, with these generic brands taking the stage in Europe, American grocers are watching this, you know, American grocers with declining profits are watching this closely. And in the late 70s,
you're describing exciting times. All those grocers
on the edge of their seat, watching the numbers come in from Europe. And it starts to be regional grocers first in Chicago and Boston and New York. Back when there were regional grocery chains.
Right.
We should explain to the future links that that's all gone now.
The sentient Piggly Wigglies that are listening and saying, what do you mean?
The sentient Pigglies have been eaten by the sentient Food Lions.
Oh, sure.
And now it's just Food Lions roaming
the prairies. No. The sentient Pigglies lay down with the sentient Food Lions.
It's a real grocery utopia.
You know, I'm an optimist and you're a pessimist.
And it eventually spreads to the larger chains. And the idea here is that you can save a lot of money on things like advertising. You don't have to run national ad campaigns for your salad dressing if it's just a white bottle that says salad dressing. Because that's what these things were. There was no fun packaging or marketing at all.
Oh, it wasn't store brand. It just said
store brands already salad existed. Dressing. Yeah, like A&P still already sold A&P salad dressing, Thousand Island dressing. But this was the ethos was this is as bare bones as we can make it. This is cheaper than store. Typically, these things would be about 10 to 40% cheaper than the house brands. And 30 to 50% cheaper than the national brands.
Now, where is this on the? I think of us also being on somewhat of a timeline where food is beginning to be polluted by preservatives and like taste chemicals that aren't actually food, and you know, like dyes and there was a time I think where you could buy salad dressing that just said salad dressing because it hadn't occurred to anybody that there was a version of salad dressing that wasn't made out of oil, vinegar, cheese, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, that. But now when I would look, if I looked at a bottle that said salad dressing on a white label, I would think, oh, that's garbage. It's full of chemicals.
It's going to have five things I recognize and then xanthan gum. And
no recognizable ingredients. And so where are we on that timeline of kind of the evolution of food from even cheap food in 1950 was probably made out of
three things.
Yeah, three things. And by 1985, I start to feel like we're in this weird where food has a lot of like plastic in it.
My sense is this by the late 70s, these would have been heavily processed foods for the most part. But you know, a lot of the things that were sold as generics were just a can of green beans.
Right.
Ingredients, green beans.
As Mindy would say.
No recipe. And the ones that were sold as generics would have been lower grade. This is not just the same as house brands where typically they might be running out of the same plant even. It's just a slightly cheaper alternative that saves on advertising costs. This was actually the fruits and vegetable, the produce might be a lower grade. You know, it might be irregular apples in the applesauce. The peach syrup might have less sugar. The generic peanut butter was often not made out of whole peanuts, apparently, but with what one article describes as splits and runners.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know in the peanut industry what that is, but
splits and runners. It's also, it's a way that they grade pantyhose.
Yeah. Do they have generic pantyhose?
But they do.
I guess isn't that effectively what legs was in the egg? Wasn't that just
think that was that legs cost more.
Oh, is that true? Cause you get an egg.
It was grocery store pantyhose you want to avoid.
But you know, there'd be fewer varieties of these things. It would be slightly lower grade and you could, maybe in a taste test, if there was a Consumer Reports taste test, you could say, this beer is not as good, this detergent doesn't wash as well.
Well, you know, I always was fairly convinced about that sort of irregular fruit or splits and runners logic, because a piece of fruit is bruised, but if you're putting it into applesauce, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And if a peanut is split before it goes into the peanut butter maker.
I have to assume that's what splits and runners are.
Yeah, it makes no difference because you're chopping it all up anyway.
It's like homeopathy. The peanut butter remembers.
But if you're standing there as a buyer and a crate of whole peanuts comes up and a crate of split peanuts comes up, of course you're going to pay more for, you know, you're going to, the whole peanuts are going to get charged at a higher rate because, you know, they're beautiful and there they are. But in terms of making peanut butter, it probably doesn't make a difference. So I was always somewhat convinced by that argument. It's just at the point at which it's a choice between sugar and aspartame or a choice between aspartame and lespartame.
Cyclamates?
Yeah. Or that it starts to become an issue, right? Where it's like, oh, well, we couldn't find real cheese, so we put government cheese. We couldn't find real government cheese, so we put...
gym mats.
Yeah, right.
Insulation.
That was that, and trying to figure out where that line is between, is this just splits and runners, or are we talking about...
I think in general, stuff tasted pretty good.
Yeah.
It was, you know, if you did an A-B test, you could maybe tell that the generic was not as high quality or something. And I think it would be mostly true in cases of the things with recipes, as Mindy would say. Right. Like the boxed dinners might be noticeably worse, for example. But the ethos was people didn't care. Like you were buying economy, and everything about the packaging screamed this. If you remember right, they would just kind of, they would boast of their blankness. They were these empty white squares and cylinders with the name of the product written in kind of big, bold, sans serif type. And it would say peaches or rice or whatever. No picture, no advertising.
I remember evoking a couple of things, and one of them was we were far enough away from the bomb shelter culture of the late 50s, early 60s, that this felt like a little bit of a wink and a nod to that sort of space race era. You're going to put a whole turkey dinner into a pill, kind of 2001 Space Odyssey idea of
it. What looked the future futuristic.
It did.
Maybe dystopian, but definitely futuristic.
Dystopian, but there was an ironic element to it.
Yes. And
the thing about being what I imagined when those things first showed up on the shelves was not that people that really were cutting costs, people that were really counting their pennies.
Yeah, like I just saved half a cent in colored ink on this.
I don't think that they were the ones buying this. It felt like an ironic food product that you would buy, not as a joke exactly, but as a. It was statement food. It was reverse snobbery food.
Yeah, if it didn't start out that way, I think it became that way very quickly. To your dystopian point, National Lampoon very quickly ran a kind of a joking spread showing a future supermarket where every single food was just a generic white box with the name of the thing.
Food.
Yeah, it said food, and then it said drink on the other stuff.
Yeah.
And it's in Repo Man as well, right? Isn't somebody eating a box of food or something
that?
And I think
let's go get food and not pay.
And the irony happened very quickly as well. You started to see the generic ethos leaving the grocery store, and people would buy a t-shirt that was just white and said t-shirt.
Yeah. See, that's hilarious.
Get it?
Yep.
And
that's good. That's like RoboCop level
of social critique, right?
Yeah.
I remembered, I haven't thought about this for a long time. There was Marvel Comics actually put out a generic comic book that just said generic comic book. And it featured superhero battling supervillain. And it was written by writer and drawn by penciler and inker.
If you think about it, we've talked for a while about doing an episode on Le Car. And Le Car is the French.
That's right.
It's a French joke because it's not even a French car.
Is there some overlap with the punk aesthetic here of just that stark? Like it looks, they kind of look like punk show flyers, right? With
right.
the stark white and black stripped down look. It almost seems like you're not just reaching out to penny-pinching housewives. It also might be kids that like this stripped-down look.
Well, yeah. And I never saw those products as things for penny-pinching housewives. It always felt like if you had food in a food box, it was college student stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was punk. It was, and then it was like anti-punk, or it was, you know, like punk didn't want to be that easy. And so it became a kind of, it was like bro punk kind of.
Yeah. Cause it's not the minimalism of the White Album. You know, it actually says, noodles on it or whatever in big Helvetica type. It kind of reminds me of, do you remember when that Jane's Addiction record got censored? And so they just put out one that was just an all white cover with the First Amendment written in sans serif type.
Well, you can count on Perry Farrell to.
He really stuck it to the man there, didn't he?
He did. Eat it.
But I think you don't get that without the generic food boom of a decade earlier. You know, the idea that, oh yeah, we're going to call attention to the fact that this is nothing but a white void with black type.
Yeah. Well, and it's also the rise of anti-commercialism.
Yes, exactly. That's right. You're not giving money to Kraft or General Mills.
Right. And I'm not, you know, I'm not somebody that's like taken in by your whole
your
Madison Avenue.
Your funny cartoon mascot and your slick slogans.
Yeah, forget that, man. It's all the same, man.
And maybe what was both the genius and the downfall of this is that it was an amazing visual to the shopper because all these foods were segregated into a ghetto aisle of the supermarket.
Oh, there was a generic aisle.
Yes, and it was for a very simple reason, which is that manufacturers did not want their products to be shelved right next to an equivalent one that was a third cheaper.
So the manufacturer lobby got to big grocery.
Yeah, and it, honestly, the stores were not loving it either because their own store brands were suffering as well.
Right. Well, so I remember that. I remember the generic aisle and going down, it was like dish soap.
It was everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was canned pears right next to detergent and
you were suddenly in a black and white movie instead of in a color movie. And it did feel, I mean, I bought that stuff. I bought generic dish soap but I couldn't stand generic toilet paper. I think you go down the line and you're like, which one of these things am I willing to, you know, generic cat food? Sure. Who cares? It's just a stupid cat.
I asked Mindy about brand loyalty and she said, well, you should talk about toilet paper. And I said, why? She said, 'cause I kept buying the Kirkland stuff. And finally you were like, Mindy, after Jeopardy, you were like, Mindy, I'm a millionaire now. Like, yeah. Buy real toilet
paper. Get the soft toilet paper. This is a problem I have with my East Coast friends. They all, no matter how well they do in life, they still buy Scott toilet paper because they have some idea of themselves as like, that's
man of the people.
Thrifty or good enough. And I'm like, Scott tissue paper is prison toilet paper. And if there's one thing you're going to spend money on, it's the softest, cushiest toilet paper that money could buy.
I mean, I remember sitting as a kid being pushed by this row of white groceries, and it totally worked as a marketing tool. I was like, what is happening on aisle 6?
Right.
It's insane.
There's also an environmental idea.
Oh, yeah. There, I didn't think about that.
Right? That we're trying to reduce waste. We're trying to reuse and recycle. And this generic stuff feels just one step closer to
cardboard.
Yeah. Already being in the landfill.
Yeah. And I wonder if that was if shoppers were appealed to on that basis, or if it was just a tiny bit early for that. But in any case, it turned out to be a bit of a fad. It didn't last. You will not see an aisle of monochromatic groceries in any store today, Futurelings. And in our era, this is at least, it's almost 40 years gone.
It is generic beer that killed it, because there's one thing that should have sold it, which is generic beer, because 15% of the beer buying public just wants beer.
Just looks for the cheapest label.
They do not care. They just want beer. My recently deceased brother drank the cheapest Keystone Ice Light that he could get because beer is a thing that you want to consume in quantities. In fact, you want to consume mass quantities of beer.
Yeah, nobody says, hey, do you want a Michelob? Unless you're in an ad. What you say is, hey, can I grab you a beer?
Do you want a beer? And if you're with fancy people, you grab a fancy beer. Wait a minute. I'm just thinking, did the Coneheads drink generic beer?
Oh, that would be right in line with that kind of National Lampoon, Repo Man, comic aesthetic right there.
Yeah, right. They drank.
And Carrefour is in France, so.
They drank 6 packs of beer, and they would drink the whole 6 pack, you know, they wouldn't take it out of the plastic containers. They would just sit and drink it.
Maybe they drank Billy beer.
Oh, wouldn't that have been good?
Did they? Can you find any evidence that the Coneheads drank generic beer?
I'm trying to look here. Hang on just a second.
A few things happened to end the fad. The you know, ghettoizing it in one aisle of the supermarket, I think it actually worked, even though it probably fascinated shoppers and led to a lot of trend pieces being written about the generic food boom. In fact, sales were never that great because you would not know, you know, if you're going to, you know where to go in the store to buy mustard, right, but you're not going to think, let me go to the generic aisle and get my mustard and my fabric softener and my, you know, it violates the way people shop.
Right. You would either have to commit to going to the generic aisle first.
Yeah.
Or forget to, and then at the end be like, oh, I could have, like, I bet you saw that fairly often, that in the generic aisle there were a bunch of name brand products that people had taken out of their shopping yeah, carts exactly, and put on the shelf when they realized. So I'm looking at a can of Conehead beer, and it actually is, it is a white label and it says beer on it, but it looks like it has the Schlitz. It has some kind of logo on it, an emblem. Oh,
interesting. So but it's more like just a non-product placement thing?
Yeah, but it does just say, it is just a white label that says beer in that same black font. So Coneheads might have been like early adopters. That would have been 1977.
They're thought leaders. They're influencers. Yeah, 77 is right when this started up in the States. A couple other things happened that hastened the end of the fad. One is that digital printing technology got cheaper. It was no longer prohibitive to print color labels, or specifically to switch labeling in the middle of a production line run.
Oh.
So it became much easier to just, you know, have a green bean plant turn out
17 brands.
Yeah. And keep switching labels. The other thing is that stores, seeing that this could work, stores introduced their own neo-generics, as they were then called, mm-hmm, which is kind of a tiered level of store brands. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of this today.
Safeway Select.
And yeah, then, exactly. You've got your President's Premium Choice, but then you've also got Foodland, you know, and they're both Kroger brands. It's just that one conveys, guess what? You just saved 17 cents on chili, and one conveys, you're a discriminating customer, sir. This is essentially as good as Starbucks.
It's crazy because Kroger has gone and purchased a lot of grocery store chains.
Yeah.
Kroger in Seattle owns QFC. And also Fred Meyer.
Yes. And Safeway and Albertsons now have the same parent company too, which has led to a lot of grocery stores shutting down where there's a Safeway and Albertsons like four blocks away.
But what you see then is you go to Safeway and then on the shelves there are Safeway brand and Albertsons brand. You go to Fred Meyer and there's Kroger stuff. And you go to the competitor across the street, QFC, and there's Kroger stuff.
It's anarchy.
It's the
illusion of free market capitalism. Right?
Well, yeah. It's one of the reasons we can't tax the rich. And that concludes Generic Food, entry 521.JB1817, certificate number 34402 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era and there are still distinct brands of social media, rather than just generic social media.
I'm going to go get on social.
I am on social media. We still had social media sort of not even really with that much diversity, but we did have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
We have the fake diversity of Kroger, which is, you know, Facebook kind of encouraging the young people to get onto Instagram.
Who owns TikTok now?
TikTok's owned by the Chinese still, I think, isn't it?
Okay, well.
So it's basically the government of China.
Anyway, you can go on these different places, Reddit. We don't have much of a presence on the U.S. government social media sites, but I'm sure there are a lot of government employees here that could add us to some kind of DARPA listserv. But we're at Omnibus Project at all those places. Ken and I are on Twitter at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. I'm also on Instagram at John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can join our...
Don't send anything timely because I read it about once a month. So if you're like, hey, I want you to call my grandma for Mother's Day.
It's too late.
Not going to happen.
Yeah. I watch Ken open the mail right here in front of me, and it's always, he always goes, oh, look, oh, I forgot, we have mail. And then he pulls out like an apple crate. But we do read it, and it is wonderful to get it.
We love our mail. Did you read the P.O. Box address? Mail.
You can mail us things at P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155.
Right now I'm reading a magazine that randomly showed up in the mailbox of Mike, an Alberta engineer who listens to the show, but he does not know why he received the Journal of the Northern Territories Water and Waste Association.
That is something I'm going to avidly consume as soon as this program's over.
He says he was captivated and has never been so immediately interested in everything. Now, the Northern Territories, and I didn't know this, is apparently Canadian term of art for the Northwest Territories and Nunavut.
Yeah.
But not Yukon?
No, I don't think so. The Northern Territories are, because it used to be...
There used to just be Northwest Territories.
Right, there wasn't Nunavut. And
they split off. Nunavut had a coup.
They have
the Nunavutians wanted self-rule.
They have very distinctive, they're super distinctive universes. Yukon Territory is its own thing.
And here are some sample headlines from this magazine. Community Wastewater Infiltration System at Setermoen, Troms County, Arctic Norway. So it appears to be about the problems of water infrastructure in the Arctic.
Well, yeah, because you're dealing with permafrost. You've got a lot of thaw and freeze.
Here, you'll enjoy this it's a very lushly illustrated feature about a water sewer system retrofit in Fort Smith, Northwest Territories.
I've been noticing in my own backyard, which has a small creek, that there, somewhere upstream of me, there is a there's a cistern, and the local government is managing the water in such a way that every once in a while I'll be down in the creek, you know, catching pollywogs, and the flow will increase by 50%.
Like somebody turned a switch?
Like someone, yeah, opened a, you know, like hand cranked a valve.
This is how Chinatown starts. You're going to die.
I know. And then I'm down in the creek and all of a sudden it's got all this water. And then an hour later it subsides and goes back to its regular flow. And I don't know what city agency, I'm super curious. I need to do some investigation because somewhere upstream there's somebody in some coveralls that's making decisions that are affecting my life.
Oh, and here's one more Pokemon card I forgot to give your daughter. I hope she wants Feraligatr.
I'm sure she does.
But that did not come in the mail. That just happened to be in this bag.
Oh, I see.
So yeah, here you go.
Nice.
If anybody wants to subscribe to the Journal of the Northern Territories Water and Waste Association, check it out. Thanks, Mike.
Look at that. That's beautiful. Also, let me encourage you to support the show by contributing to our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. In doing so, you get access to a lot of bonus content. We do a addenda episode every month where we review reader mail. And
denigrate it.
And we take other things into consideration.
We rate it all on a scale of red half circle to black full circle with nipple.
Very occasionally, we will admit having missed a point, or we will sometimes even admit wrongdoing, and we will amend our entries.
Only in cases where the statute of limitations has expired, right, or there's no legal liability in any U.S. state.
It hardly ever happens. Mostly, we just rip the correspondence to shreds. Because we have our rapier-like combined wit.
Typically, it's not corrections so much as it is
addenda.
Here's a cool thing you guys should have mentioned, and fair enough, we should have.
You forgot that this thing that I've studied my whole life, I know more about than you.
Because nominally, this is a complete compendium of all the knowledge of our time, so really, anytime we leave anything out,
it needs to be
we have let you the future down.
But also, if you contribute to our Patreon, there are several tiers, as is the style of the time, and some of those tiers include you receiving actual physical gifts from us, including the show notes that we use to record the shows themselves.
Like this illegible piece of paper that says generic food, U-Market, Carrefour, segregation, neo-generics. And now at the bottom it says cheese cubes and nautical theme because I'm jotting down ideas for the show description.
Yeah.
No, Cheese Cubes is not its own show.
Cheese Cubes!
You have access.
Cheese cubes. That was my favorite Jay Giles song.
Cheese cubes.
Cheese cubes.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We outlasted the gimmick that was generic foods. We have no idea which gimmicks currently extant will outlive us. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, could very well be our final word to you. We hope not. We hope that Providence will allow us to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.